Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth. Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is the most frequently quoted economic indicator, and yet, what is GDP? Like many people, I could tell you that it stands for gross domestic product, but not what it does and doesn't measure. How reliable is it? For a statistic used in virtually every economic conversation, it appears that the true meaning of GDP is anything but clear. We wanted to make sure that we weren't the only ones scratching our heads, so we sent Taylor Quimby onto the street to ask people what they know about GDP.
Do you know what GDP is?
GDP?
GDP. Gross domestic product? I'm not sure.
Can you give me a hint?
Gross domestic product?
Domestic.
Policy?
Gross domestic product?
It involves economics, if I'm correct, right?
Now, do you know, like, how they come up with it, or like what it means, or what it actually is?
No, not really.
Isn't it how much we make within the United States, earn like profits?
The average earnings of businesses, I don't know. You tell me.
Off the top of my head, I can't remember, but yeah, I know the general. I was able to do it on my test last week, but.
I don't know all that. I have no idea.
So given how much GDP gets bandied about in politics and TV news and reports on the economy, maybe we should know a bit more. With us is economist Diane Coyle, author of GDP, A Brief But Affectionate History. Hello, Diane.
Hello.
So what is GDP? We got it right? Gross domestic product?
Gross domestic product is right, and it is the total sum of all the activity in the economy measured in dollars. So it's a single aggregate measure of how well the economy is doing.
Do you happen to know how much the US gross domestic product is currently?
I don't for the US. I can tell you for the UK, £1.6 trillion. But it's not actually a very interesting number, is it? We're more interested in how quickly it's growing, because that's what affects people's job prospects.
When and why was the GDP indicator created?
It dates back to the 1930s in the form that we know it, and was a product of the Great Depression, when for the first time people expected the government to do something about it when the economy was doing very badly, and the government of the day realized it didn't actually have a measure to help it set policy or give it any guide. It knew how many banks were failing and how much steel was being produced, but not the total. And then the Second World War took over. There was a great need for the US and the UK to understand the productive capacity of the economy and also what kind of sacrifice consumers were going to have to make to sustain the war effort. And there was a great debate at the time about, should we try to measure the activity of the economy and how much it could produce, or should we try to measure instead how well off people felt in some more fundamental sense? And that debate was won by measuring the economy, because that was the need of the war. But that debate has come back now, and there are lots of questions about whether it is actually the right kind of measure for the government and policymakers.
Well, it seems much easier to count numbers than quality of life. How is GDP calculated for a country like the U.S.? I mean, one can kind of imagine a very, very, very long line of columns on one side of a very big spreadsheet.
It's very complicated, and the handbook that guides statisticians is well over 800 pages long. But essentially, they're collecting figures from all the different industries that make up the economy: haircuts, manufacturing, cars, legal services, meals out in restaurants, the whole lot, done by collecting surveys, and they have to all be added up together and combined into one single number. And it's a very complicated process.
Who's doing the work?
There are official statistical bodies in every country around the world, and the ones in the US and the UK are the leading ones. They do the best quality work, and so they put a lot of resource. It's one of the main activities that they carry out.
When we hear economists talk about GDP, it often sounds very stable, very fixed. How much of it is actually guesswork? I mean, how can you figure out how many people are getting haircuts and paying for them?
There is a lot of guesswork and uncertainty involved in it. There is the kind of measurement error, because it is very difficult to know exactly how many haircuts are being delivered in the economy every year. There are the uncertainties about how much things change from season to season. The fact that a quarter of all books are sold in the month before Christmas is a predictable variation. You're much more interested in abstracting from that. People want to adjust for changes in price and quality. So, for example, a computer that you spend $1,500 on today would be much better quality than one that you bought for the same price 5 years ago, so they want to make that kind of adjustment too. And there are all sorts of judgments about what goes in and what stays out. Famously, housework, because it isn't sold at a market price, mm-hmm. doesn't go into GDP, but you know, you'd say that was a very important activity in the economy.
The idea that values are assigned leaves the GDP question open to conspiracy theories. At least that's something that we've heard a lot of here in the U.S., that those numbers aren't accurate, that there is a real GDP or it's not a measure of true inflation. Any thoughts on that?
I think that misunderstands the way to think about the economy. People have this idea that there is a true number, and it's like measuring the height of a mountain or the length of a river, and you can get more and more accurate about it. It's actually much more of a judgment about what you want to try to measure. So if you're only interested in the dollar value spent, then you wouldn't need to try to make any adjustments for inflation. But if you are interested in inflation and in real living standards, then there is actually a debate to be had, and people can take different viewpoints about, are you adjusting for those quality changes in computers and electronic goods, or are you not? So it's really a question of thinking about the purpose of what you want the numbers for.
You give a terrific example of how the way that GDP is calculated can have huge implications on its outcome. Can you tell us about the GDP of Ghana, which recently flipped?
Yes, and there was an even more recent example in Nigeria. A lot of statistical offices in low-income countries don't have the same capacity to keep the figures up to date that we do in the US and the UK. And in particular, keeping track of what are the important industries in the economy. So every 5 years or so in the US, the statisticians will change the weights on the different industries to come up with a total number, because we're not making horse-drawn carriages anymore, so they've got a zero weight these days and they didn't write at the start. In some African countries, that hasn't been done for many years. So in Ghana and recently in Nigeria, they introduced for the first time the figures for the movie industry, the figures for the mobile phone sector, and that took Ghana's GDP up by 60% overnight and Nigeria's up by 89% overnight. So their economy was almost twice as big as they had said the day before. And of course, nothing real changed. People were as well off as they had been the day before or not. But the measure of GDP was completely transformed by this exercise.
We're speaking with the economist Diane Coyle. She's visiting research fellow at the University of Oxford's Smith School of Enterprise and the Environment. And we're talking about the economic indicator we hear about all the time, but may know very little about, GDP, gross domestic product. Well, you heard our producer, Taylor Quimby, out on the street trying to find out how much people know about GDP. Now, he did talk to one gentleman who was quick to say why he thought GDP was a bad indicator of economic health. Let's hear what he had to say.
Everything adds to GDP. You know, a hurricane destroys a bunch of buildings, kills a bunch of people. That adds to GDP. You know, World Trade Center blew down. That increased the GDP of New York substantially. It cost a lot of money to put that building back together. You know, there's other indicators. There's gross domestic happiness, I think, is there some sort of happiness indicator, which is based more on quality of life, how expensive things are for you, how much access you have to services in your country and your community. And, obviously I think it's a better indicator. You'll find places like Sweden are a lot better, even though they have much smaller GDPs, much more enjoyable to live there. Yeah.
Well, Diane Coyle, whether you prefer Sweden to the U.S. is not really the question, but let's talk about where GDP does fall short, what it doesn't measure or the things that it does calculate might be important when we're considering the economic health of a nation.
I think there were some great points just made there. GDP does simply what it says. It measures in dollars the value of economic activity. So if there is a natural disaster and there is rebuilding going on, that increases GDP. Right back at the beginning, Simon Kuznets, who was one of the fathers of the figures, argued that advertising should be excluded because it didn't contribute to anybody's well-being. Hmm. But of course, dollars are spent in the industry, so that's in GDP as well. So there are all kinds of things that are in there that we might want to exclude if we're thinking about people's well-being. But there are also things that are not in there that we would want to include, and mainly that's the importance of innovations. Nathan Mayer Rothschild, who was the richest man in the world at the time, died from a tooth abscess because antibiotics hadn't been invented. The value to people's lives of inventing a new medicine like that is never captured by adequately by the dollar value of what gets spent on it. Now we have all kinds of new digital inventions, and their value too is almost certainly not captured by GDP.
I was curious about that. How do you value things that you find on the web? I mean, YouTube
a lot of it's free. So
right, it is, exactly. So how do you assign a meaningful price when no price is asked?
Well, the fact is that you can't, and so that gets undercounted. If you want to use it to measure people's well-being, then you need to think about a different approach and a different kind of statistic.
I guess another question comes up for me. If GDP measures prices, it must be difficult to calculate in a global supply chain. You know, you buy an iPhone, but the components are coming maybe from four different countries, rare earth metals from China or Peru, or the battery from some other place. How do all of those contributions get calculated when the final price is paid at a US or UK Apple store?
Well, again, that's not well covered by the current statistics that we have. There are some new statistics that try to take out the separate components of those global supply chains, and they would make a big difference to looking at the US-China trade imbalance, for example, because a lot of the components that are assembled in China are imported from other countries like South Korea or Germany or Japan. And economists are just beginning to work with those figures and understand them. But GDP is a national concept, and we have a global economy now. So that's another way in which the current statistics don't actually map well onto the questions that we might want to ask.
So what do we do? A revised GDP that takes some of these other things into account?
Well, no, I would say not, because that GDP concept is useful for some things. And as long as you don't try and use it for anything else, that's okay. But I think we need to work better at understanding global flows and also at understanding the different components of people's well-being. One simple thing is to look at GDP per capita, which economists rarely do, but also look at the things that we know contribute to people's welfare, like unemployment is a very obvious one. But also in Scandinavia, you'd be concerned about work-life balance or the role of women in the workplace. Why not measure those things directly if you think they're important policy questions?
I'm guessing because the answer is because it's easy to throw out a number like the GDP that gets calculated and thrown out by the media, thrown out by politicians. Do you think we're setting too much store by GDP? And if that's going to hurt us, hurt our economic future?
I think we are. Because we've got into the habit of thinking it's the one that matters. And so there's this ritual when the figures come out and everybody obsesses about whether it's 0.2 or 0.3 without remembering that the uncertainty around the figure is bigger than the number itself. And I think we just need to break the habit. And part of that will be having the national statistical agencies start to work on collecting other kinds of data. How much natural resources are being used and what does that imply for future growth? Let's concentrate on jobs and long-term unemployment. And I think there is some hope of getting the debate to move on to that, because I never really quite understand why politicians want to claim the credit for GDP, which they don't control, when they get the blame when it all goes wrong. And so there is some hope, I think, that if we work on other ways of using different statistics, we can move the conversation on.
Economist Diane Coyle, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Diane Coyle's new book is called GDP, A Brief but Affectionate History. You can find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter at wordofmouth. When Word of Mouth continues, one of those thriving service markets that is difficult to tally into the GDP, the tattoo business. You need disposable income to get one and a canny eye to draw a good one. A tattoo artist in a preppy enclave after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Once seen as a trademark of sailors and rebellious teenagers, a 2012 Harris poll found that 1 in 5 U.S. adults has a tattoo. The annual revenue of the tattoo industry is now north of $2.3 billion. Pretty good gig if you can get it. Angel Quinones first became interested in tattoos growing up next to a motorcycle club. He got inked for the first time at 17, started tattooing when he was in college, and is now proprietor of his own tattoo shop on Martha's Vineyard.
Whitney Jones shares his story.
I mean, do you even know how this works?
No, not at all.
Okay. The tattoo machine was invented by Thomas Edison. I have my degree right here, and people are like, oh, you went to Brown? And I'm like, yeah, I went to Brown. And, you know, they're totally shocked. So I guess the assumption sometimes is that if you're a tattoo artist, you're not that intelligent or, you know, perhaps brutish. But, you know, they don't know that I'm a bibliophile. I have thousands of books, and that's all I do when I'm not tattooing, read and paint and sculpt. Where I grew up, we lived next to a motorcycle club, and a lot of the guys that were in the motorcycle club had tattoos, and I hadn't, you know, before that I had never seen tattoos, and I just got absorbed into it. And then I guess when I was about 17 or 18, I got my first tattoo, probably the first tattoo in my entire family. And people didn't get it. They're like, well, why are you doing this? My first tattoo is a Native American symbol. It's a sun, and I got it on my back. And being Puerto Rican and of a mestizo background, you know, I've always been drawn to the different elements, you know, of my culture. And when I was younger, you know, I wanted to stay within that realm, that spectrum, sort of like connect with, you know, my ancestors, my past somehow. And, you know, I was only 17, so, and it covered my entire back. Now it's sort of shrunk to the middle of my back. But that was my first tattoo. And I mean, yes, you know, a lot of people's tattoos have very deep meaning to them. And some, you know, are just, you know, getting tattooed for the heck of it. The way the tattoo works is that the ink is drawn up. When you dip the tattoo machine into the ink, the needle going up and down, vibrating up and down, pulls ink into the reservoir of the tube. And when you're piercing the skin with the needle, ink is being vibrated sort of down the shaft of the tube and onto the needle, and it's being pushed into the skin. I mean, I got my first tattoo, and then maybe I got another couple. And as I said, you know, I've always been an artist, and I started thinking, it's like, you know, I could probably do this. I was working all the time, you know, at the library, at school, and then I'd go get a tattoo, and, like, my money would be gone. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is probably a good way to make money. And I got the equipment in, and I was living with some roommates. And I'm like, who's first? And they're like, no way, man. And I was like, okay, I got to buckle down and tattoo myself. And I did this tattoo on my calf of a Sacred Heart. And, you know, my roommate sat there and watched, and it came out, you know, pretty good. But just to get the feel, you know, I mean, I'd never done a tattoo. So, you know, you have to start somewhere. So I started on myself. And it's actually never actually part of your skin. You know, it sits between the layers of the dermis, and it sort of has its own atmosphere inside of your skin. If you look at a tattoo through a microscope, it's a bunch of little balls of pigment kind of just floating there. For when I first got tattooed, almost every shop, you know, there was some older biker guy, scary guy. You wouldn't talk to him at all, never mind tell him a story or start crying in front of him because he'd probably throw you out of his shop. But with the popularity of these shows like Miami Ink and New York Ink and LA Ink, I mean, these shows have, you know, vaulted tattoos and tattooing into the limelight. And people that would never think about getting a tattoo or would have never, you know, even been exposed to what a tattoo shop looks or feels like feel comfortable. Because they've seen it on television, and then, you know, they start getting ideas that they want a tattoo, and they're like, okay, I can do it because it's cool, it's on television, you know? The skill is being able to do the fill. It's drawing versus painting, and having an art background helps because perspective, you know, lighting and, you know, color theory all come into play. It's So here you are, and you're trying to get all these subtleties, you know, with different washes of gray in the face, and this person's like bleeding. And when you get done with the portrait, it looks like a bloody mess. And people are like, what's going on here? And it's like, you have to wait for it to heal to really see. I mean, you as the artist have it forever if you take a photograph of it. But even then, as the years go by, it does change. You know, this image, it's forever for them. But, I mean, they walk out the door. I think about that all the time.
Angel Quinones there, a tattoo artist on the Vineyard. While there are thousands of professional tattoo artists across the country, they are not unionized yet. Up next, from video dancers to runway models, those with untraditional jobs are organizing to various degrees of success. A look into alternative labor activism after the news.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A hearing held by the House Education and Workforce Committee last Thursday became a congressional grilling of NCAA and Division I school leaders over not sufficiently addressing grievances among student athletes. The hearing was triggered by the federal ruling that tentatively allowed scholarship football players at Northwestern University to unionize. The Boston Globe's Leon Nafok observed how differently a union of collegiate athletes would look from the blue-collar factory workers who've traditionally been the face of American labor. He found that among plummeting private sector union membership, a number of disparate groups are experimenting with worker advocacy and replacing unions as we know them. His article, Not Your Grandpa's Labor Union, appeared in the Boston Globe Ideas section. Leon, great to speak with you again.
Thanks for having me again.
So unlike the early industrial era, when there was the likelihood of getting killed or maimed or working, you know, 7 days a week spurred unionization, what is behind today's varied worker advocacy groups?
So basically, there are more and more people who have jobs or who earn money, let's say, through non-traditional employment situations. They are part-time or they're independent contractors. The technical term is precarious or contingent workers, which means they don't have job security, they don't have contracts, they're misclassified as independent contractors or freelancers, even though they're doing the work of a permanent staff member. Basically, all these people can't really unionize in the way someone who is a permanent worker at a factory could back in the industrial era.
So there's a kind of vulnerability, but why isn't traditional unionization not an option for them?
So, okay, like if you look at for example, the fast food workers who have been trying to organize, they are employees of these franchises, right? So do those people work for that one restaurant or do they work for McDonald's Corporation?
Mm-hmm.
In order for them to organize in a meaningful way, you would have to go with the latter. But McDonald's so far has said, well, no, actually, you guys are employees of, you know, this one restaurant. If you'd like to organize the 30 of you or whatever, fine. But that's not really effective. Another example is like fashion models,
mm-hmm.
you know, who face various kinds of, you know, inhumane hours and sexual harassment in the fashion industry. To their sort of to their rescue, recently has come the Model Alliance, and it's not a union. They can't give these models collective bargaining rights because they're all independent contractors. They're all essentially freelancers, and so by having this organization that's not a union, again, they can use their platform to put pressure on the industry, you know, by writing op-eds, by filing lawsuits, by lobbying for laws to protect their members.
Well, I suppose fashion models could not be further from the old image of the Teamsters or something back in the day.
Yeah.
The manufacturing sector is clearly no longer the model. But remind us, like, how much of a decline, how much of an anti-union moment are we in at this right now?
It's been plummeting and plummeting. At its peak, 35% of the private sector workforce was unionized, and that was back in the 50s. Last year, it was 6.6%.
Wow. Well, you gave us the example of the models, but there are also jazz musicians who are trying to unite for better working conditions from nightclub owners, graduate students, adjunct professors, and video music dancers. If you could, you can pick any of those, but what are some of their complaints and some of the tactics, non-traditional tactics, they're using to address them?
The music video dancers, again, like models, they're often classified as independent contractors. They felt powerless in terms of the working conditions that they were being forced to accept. You know, to be specific, they would be asked to come in at 5 a.m. to be on set, even though they wouldn't actually be on the schedule to perform until much later. It was just easier for their employers to say, get there early and leave late. You know, there were issues involving knee damage, you know, from being forced to dance for hours on concrete without any kind of protective gear. And so they started working with SAG-AFTRA, which is an established union. And so they are now unionized as part of that union. The way they got there, despite the obstacle that they faced, which was that they were, again, not technically employees of anyone, they made videos, you know, designed to be viral, where they were trying to connect with other dancers around the country. They would hold meetings, you know, not at the proverbial union hall, but at dance studios and nightclubs. And, you know, it worked. They got this multi-employer industry-wide contract, which now covers every music video that you see produced by any major record label.
Well, when you talk about video music dancers, graduate students, adjunct professors, you're talking mostly about young, educated populations, maybe more likely to be bold about their prospects or their ability to influence their workplaces collectively. How about those traditionally low-wage people who, you know, are working in restaurants or dishwashers or cooks mm-hmm. or bartenders? How yep. are they organizing?
Yeah, so for them, there's this New York-based organization called the Restaurant Opportunity Center. Like the Model Alliance, it's not a union. It is an organization that these people can join. They're one of their main tactics so far has been suing employers who, you know, do things like illegally withhold pay or provide dangerous working conditions for their employees. Because a lot of the problem for these folks is that they might work at one restaurant one week and then they'll work at a different one the following week. Mm-hmm. So in that scenario, like you can't unite with your fellow workers just because it's all so fractured.
Right.
To have the Restaurant Opportunity Center, which is one of the, I think, most established so-called worker centers that have sprung up over the last couple of decades, you know, as the Restaurant Opportunity Center, they can sue for back pay, for example.
Well, lawsuits then, rather than striking or collective bargaining. I'm wondering how traditional labor regards these fledgling groups.
Yeah, so I was really interested to find out that in the beginning, when these worker centers were first starting out, they were treated with great skepticism by traditional union organizers because they were seen as sort of diluting the labor movement because for all the potential good they can do, the people that join with them, they can't do the main thing that gave traditional unions power, which was collectively bargain. Hmm. And that tool is why unions, you know, made things happen. And without it, one could argue that there's not the same kind of leverage, you know. But with time, I think the skepticism has sort of melted away a little bit, if only because traditional union organizing has suffered so much.
Outside of the unions, though, there's a whole political realm. I mean, despite the downward slide of big labor, politicians still court the big organizations for votes.
Right.
If politicians can't court, you know, these disparate little pockets of alt labor, can mm-hmm. those who are representing new ways of organizing really make any kind of difference in the political realm?
Yeah, well, I think some of them succeed at getting the attention of politicians. I mean, the Model Alliance, for example, they succeeded at getting a law passed in New York, which extended child labor protections to underage models. There's also the Domestic Workers Alliance, which lobbied for a law in New York that basically extended a bunch of different kinds of labor protections to nannies, caregivers, you know, people who, again, work for an individual family. Now, other states are looking at, you know, doing similar things. What's tricky still, you know, it's great that they got these laws are being passed, but a skeptic might say, well, it's still not capable of doing the thing that a labor union could do in the past because each nanny, each caregiver, each housekeeper, they work for someone different.
Right.
You know, even the ones who work for agencies, you know, how can you organize when the person on the other side of the table is not a person? It's, you know, it's a whole mess of different kinds of people.
Well, Neon Nafok, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Leon Nafok, staff writer for the Boston Globe Ideas section. You'll find a link to read his article, Not Your Grandpa's Labor Union, on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Word of Mouth continues with the loving side of cavemen. Archaeological evidence reveals that Neanderthals were cooperative and caring, kind of awesome parents. Stay with us for that story after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Traditionally, Neanderthals have been portrayed as hulking, grunting, club-wielding brutes, simply put, as cavemen. But that image is far from reality and fails to capture the sophistication of Paleolithic societies. Archaeologists have long known that Neanderthals used fire, made tools, and created cave paintings. But a new paper by University of York archaeologist Dr. Penny Spikens takes our understanding of prehistoric societies one step further. The cradle of thought, growth, learning, play, and attachment in Neanderthal children explores childhood in the Paleolithic period and finds that Neanderthal parents didn't just rear children, but were actually quite loving and compassionate. Penny Spikens is senior lecturer in the Archaeology of Human Origins at the Department of Archaeology at the University of York in England. Dr. Spikens, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Well, I'm aware that you and I may pronounce Neanderthal, Neanderthal differently, but let's just establish that that's what we mean.
Absolutely.
How did you go about researching something as intangible as childhood and affection?
Well, I think you come across things in the archaeological record or in our interpretations that you think, well, why aren't people talking about this? And you think, if I say Neanderthal children, people almost say, Neanderthal had children? And you think, well, you know, they must have done, but we don't really talk about them. We don't look to see if there's any evidence of them. In fact, there's quite a few people who have painted a picture of Neanderthals having a really harsh upbringing, you know, brutal parents. There was these images in publications of bones of children discarded, just thrown around caves. So, you know, I thought, well, maybe we can look at this in a little bit more detail, because very often our preconceptions of people very much colour the evidence that we look at, and the evidence might not have been quite that good. So he had a really serious look at some of the evidence for what we might be able to say about Neanderthal children. The real picture seems to be very different from the one that had been assumed.
Well, let's walk through some of those some of the archaeological records, starting with play. Is there evidence suggesting that there was play among Neanderthal children?
There's evidence, yes. On the one hand, I think there's two ways of looking at it. One is to say that actually play is really important in, you know, our nearest living relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos. And, you know, it's very important to kind of developing confidence and feeling secure. So we know that play is important to us from an evolutionary perspective. Play ought to have been important in Neanderthals from that perspective. But actually, we also find evidence for some really tiny hand axes that have been made to be a perfect little replica of a larger hand axe.
Wow.
They've not been used and used until they're small. They're actually made to be small. So it looks like these are actually sort of children's toys, but made by an adult for a child. So yes.
How much do you think contemporary children might have in common with Neanderthal children? I mean, could you imagine them playing together?
Well, that's one of the things we've been talking about, actually, because we know that Neanderthals and modern humans had contact with each other. I mean, we know that, you know, people of European and Asian descent have, you know, between 4% and 6% Neanderthal DNA. So there was interbreeding happening. But when we imagine the contact, you know, everyone I've talked to imagine these two adult men, like, sort of meeting, holding spears and, you know, having some kind of negotiation. But when we look at our other animal species, often it's the young that play together, and it might actually have been children that were playing the most important role in the mixing between the two species.
Huh. Neanderthal children did not only play, but there's also some evidence of learning. What did you find?
Well, there's evidence for children's napping patterns. That's where we've seen napping as in flint napping. That's what I mean, rather than going to sleep. I'm sure they did that too. There's several sites around different places in Europe where you can see patterns where we've got people learning how to nap flint. So it looks like
napping
this adult,
meaning scraping or forming it.
Yeah, forming stone tools. So there's people sitting on, maybe on the outside, further away from a fire or what have you, where they're making really dreadful stone tools. They don't really know what they're doing. They're very frustrated and bashing at things. And we think that's where the children are, where they're learning how to make stone tools, and they're in the presence of adults who are presumably teaching them what to do. It's actually very difficult. I mean, we look back on these people and we think, you know, oh, they're quite primitive. But I've tried a lot to make a hand axe, and I can't make anything like the sophisticated hand axes that Neanderthals made. So there was a lot of learning to do.
So parents were encouraging learning and probably play, because they presumably made those toy axes. Any evidence that Neanderthal parents loved their children?
I think there's two different things I think we can pull in with that. One is the attention that we see to children in burial. So there aren't that many Neanderthal burials, but a large amount of them are of children. And the only sort of really good evidence we have for grave goods are also found in children's burials. So it looks as if, you know, there's actually a particular focus on children. People were particularly upset when a child died and were more likely to put effort into that burial. Mm. And the way in which they're buried suggests, you know, that they were grieving, you know, they must have loved them. The other side I think we can look at is when we look at how Neanderthals lived, and we have to kind of remember that as a species they were around an awful lot longer than we yet have been. So and as a species they survived by being incredibly collaborative. There's some wonderful evidence for care for each other. There's, you know, a man who had a withered arm, a withered leg, blind in one eye, must have been looked after for perhaps 20 years. He'd probably hardly fend for himself. Mm. They took some tremendous risks in hunting. You know, they really threw themselves out there to bring in enough meat for everybody. And I don't think you get that way without, you know, a loving and secure background, or certainly it's very hard to.
But couldn't it be argued that that was for survival or strength in numbers of the band rather than something more compassionate?
Well, absolutely. But I think in really strict, if we're all going to be strictly functionalist, the people that they're looking after aren't necessarily going to be contributing. And certainly, you know, the man at Shanadar, who was very disabled and lived for a very long time, they must have realised he was never going to contribute very much. There's several situations like that. There's a child with craniosyntosis, and that child had quite severe mental defects and was looked after just as any other child. You know, I don't think they were making, we might weigh that up, I'm not sure that they were weighing up whether someone would ever be valuable or not.
Now, they didn't live entirely rosy lives, these Neanderthals. What are some of the challenges that families and these small isolated societies faced?
Well, we know that they lived a harsh life, and I think that's been one of the things that's influenced our preconceptions, and that we've tend to think that, you know, a difficult existence equates with being treated badly as a child, and they're two completely different things, really. We know from enamel defects on the teeth of children that they will have passed through, you know, phases of malnutrition. There will have been times when it was hard to find enough food. They're very robust. Neanderthals are a lot more robust than modern species. They need more calories per day to survive. And so they lived in quite small isolated groups, partly because of that. So, you know, isolation's one issue. We think that when there were climate changes, pockets of Neanderthal populations often died out. They don't seem to bounce back very well because they're quite small isolated populations, and that can make it quite hard to survive.
Your academic work has focused on empathy and emotion in prehistoric societies.
Yeah.
Did evidence of that come as a surprise to you?
It's an interesting question, because I think there's been a story of human origins for quite a few years now that fits in with our idea of who we are. And so often that happens where we think, oh, no, you know, our ancestors can't have been successful unless they were ruthless and efficient, you know, because that's what we think ought to make people successful in our societies. You know, they couldn't have been successful because they were kind and generous. But even if we look at it from an economic perspective, if people are kind and generous and your reputation matters, as we know does in modern hunter-gatherers, you know, the more generous any modern hunter-gatherer is, the more likely they are to be looked after, the more people will help them out. Actually, that as a whole works for the whole group, because it's like a kind of give and take. When times are bad, people will help you out. If you're vulnerable or ill or sick, you know, you'll be helped out in turn. Often I think we're too quick to look at our own societies and think, oh, only those who are ruthless might have survived in the past, then it's probably far from true.
Mm-hmm. Do you know Franz de Waal and his work?
Oh, absolutely, right. Yeah.
We spoke with him last week about empathy and emotion in chimpanzees and apes and bonobo populations. Yeah. I'm curious what you think the role of empathy and emotion played in the human evolutionary history.
I, in a sense, I've got a new idea in many ways, because I'm trying to propose that actually it was an ability to be altruistic and compassionate that led from that on to changes in intelligence. We look back at the archaeological record and we see increasing brain size, and we think of ourselves and we think, what's special about us is that we're intelligent and then we're clever. But we don't know whether that actually happened first. It certainly looks far more likely that societies who were in the savannas, let's say 2 million years ago, having to survive together, they had the types of predators that, you know, our nearest relatives don't have, so they had to kind of club together against big cats. They ate a lot more meat in their diet, so they were scavenging and confronting these predators. There's a lot more variable environments. They really had to work together to survive. And I think that's the kind of setting in which one's level of empathy, it suddenly becomes more important to be liked than it is to be dominating. And once that happens, people have to get a lot cleverer after that, because you have to know who your ally is going to be, who you can trust, who you can judge, you know, how you judge other people. So there's good evidence to suggest that compassion might have come first. Altruism might have been what set us on a road, which then led on to other changes, language, consciousness, greater degrees of intelligence.
Penny Spykens, I want to thank you so much for showing us a different side of Neanderthals.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Penny Spykens, Senior Lecturer in the Archaeology of Human Origins at the Department of Archaeology at the University of York. Her paper, The Cradle of Thought, Growth, Learning, Play, and Attachment in Neanderthal Children, was recently published in the Oxford Journal of Archaeology. We've got more on it at wordofmouthradio.org. So, there's evidence that Neanderthal parents were pretty great. Not all creatures raise their young with such tenderness. Take the cowbird. As parents, the species can be described pretty much with one word, deadbeat. Chester Wrangler of BirdNote tells us why.
Now, we got cowboys and cowgirls. But did you know we also have cowbirds? Back in the days when the buffalo roamed, brown-headed cowbirds, looking a lot like blackbirds, but with a shiny green-black body and that brown head they're named for, followed the buffalo herds. As the buffalo wandered across the prairies, they stirred up insects that the cowbirds ate. And since the buffalo didn't stay long in one place, cowbirds didn't have time to build a nest and tend to the business of raising young. The birds solved that problem by laying eggs in other birds' nests, letting those other parents raise their young. The cowbird eggs often hatch before their adoptive siblings, and the young cowbirds outcompete their nest mates for food. Over the years, humans have settled just about everywhere and brought with them cows. And along came the cowbirds. One female cowbird can lay up to 40 eggs in one season, usually spread over the nests of many smaller birds, including warblers, juncos, and thrushes. Some warblers are having a hard time reproducing, given all the cowbirds they end up raising. It seems the warblers have good reason for some discouraging words. BirdNote.org. I'm Chester Wrangler.
So grateful for your listening time today. If you do like what you heard, there's much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, we find the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's more coming your way this Saturday at noon and online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.